This is Dr. John Patrick. He's based in Oxford, Canada. This is his wife, Sally. They've been traveling through Malawi and here, going to Durban next. Swaziland yesterday. And he's a retired medical doctor and gives spiritual talks now, and also has set up a Christian-based university in Oxford. His main part of his long history that I'm interested in is his working with malnutrition. He was in Jamaica when I'm doing studies on how to treat malnutrition in children. Over to you, John.
Thank you.
You mentioned the title as well, because I didn't mention that.
Sorry?
You mentioned the title.
Oh, yes, sure. Okay. I'll stand up so I can see you at the back. But you're perfectly free to go to sleep whenever you wish. All right? I will not be offended. The talk I was asked to give by Patrick was, Why Are There No Hittites on the Streets of New York? The title intrigues people. It's actually stolen from an American author. And if I don't do it at the beginning, I tend to forget to do it later at the end. And sometimes people write to me afterwards and say, you never actually said why there are no Hittites on the streets of New York. Well, those of you who know your Bible know that the Hittites were a fairly important thorn in the side of Israel. But there are no Hittites anywhere in the world today. And neither are all those other tribes that you list there. And of course, in the history of the world, cultures come and go. They don't carry on indefinitely. Most cultures have one bite of the cherry. Only the Jews get recurrent bites of the cherry, so to speak. They come back from disaster that would wipe anyone else out. I mean, if I took you South Africans now to the airport and put you on a plane and you were flown off, I'd be nice to you, somewhere else in Africa, but you never came back to South Africa again, how many generations would you recognise yourselves as South Africans? It wouldn't be many, would it? It certainly wouldn't be 2,000 years. But for the Jews, they were identifiable after 2,000 years of persecution. So it's worth thinking about why they succeeded. The Hittites disappeared for the usual reasons. There was an English professor about 50 years ago who spent his whole life thinking about this question, why did cultures disappear? And at the end of his life, he came up with a series of indicators that cultures are going to die. And he says, in almost every case, the first thing to happen is when a culture no longer has agreement about what is good and what is evil. Now, the whole of the Western world no longer agrees about what is good and what is evil. There are at least three topics in every medical school in which there will be a 50-50 divide on moral issues. So we're in that state. The problem with that state is that when the people ruling you hold the opposite view to you, you're not very pleased with the laws they make, right? So you tend to break them. That's bad news because it leads to a generalized disrespect for law. And when law starts breaking down, everybody loses, including the rich. The next thing that happens after that, because you really don't want to live that way and you find yourself becoming cynical, you don't like yourself as much as you did before. And when you don't like yourself as much as you should, then you start abusing drugs and alcohol and having mindless sex, unrelated to real committed love. And then it goes on down the line in their way. I mean, in the Western world, I've spent hours of my life talking to young women, for instance, with anorexia nervosa and getting nowhere. They hate themselves. That's the problem. The next thing that happens is despair. You give up, you shrug and say, I can't change it. It's crazy for the Americans to promote democracy for the world when in American elections usually only 50% of the people vote. It doesn't work at that level. And then the last thing that happens is two forms of promiscuity. One is sexual, and the whole world is suffering from an epidemic of sexually transmitted disease at the moment. When I went to medical school, none of the girls in the class had sexually transmitted disease because the pill had not yet arrived. They were intelligent. they were not going to give their virginity away until they got one or at least and preferably two rings on their finger. That was the way it was. There was a lot of talk, but not a lot of action. That's all changed because of the pill, basically, in the Western world. Of course, in Africa, you have a huge problem too. I was saying to someone just now that the first time we came to South Africa in 1988, I gave a lecture amongst many others at Soweto Baragwanath Hospital. And it was on malnutrition, but they also asked me about HIV. It wasn't called HIV at that point. It was the new disease, initially called Guillain-Barré disease, or Slim disease. I'd seen quite a lot in Central Africa. So they asked me what I knew, and I told them. Now, people working in Emerge and places like that, and I don't know how far through the hospital, but a lot of people are triple-gloved all day, aren't they?
Double-gloved.
Hmm? Double. You're trying to save money. It's triple-gloved if you're in our part of the world. Mm. Yeah, that's not good news. And the worst one, especially within the church, is that we have got to the point where we can hold logically incompatible ideas in our head at the same time. And when you reach that point, you're in deep trouble. Because you no longer have an agreement about when something is true and when it's not. And then you start seeing political agendas creep into the definition of truth. We're in very serious trouble at that point. In other words, we've gone down all Toynbee's list. That's his total list. They're all true of us. So if he's right, we're in the last 100 years of my culture and yours. Unless we change. Amazingly, throughout history, there have been changes that brought cultures back again. So that's how the title came about. The talk itself began way back in the 80s when I was bullied into coming to Africa against my will. My wife and children wanted to come, I didn't, because having done the work in Jamaica to treat severely malnourished children, we had solved the science. When I left Jamaica in 79, we were treating severely malnourished children with a 99.9% success rate. It had been 50% when the unit started 25 years before. So the science was done. Very counterintuitive, hard for nice, kind people to do. Protein is poisonous, salt is poisonous, even too much water is poisonous. It's very difficult. But once you realise how it's done, it can be done. But it hasn't happened. I have yet to go to a mission hospital where it's being done really well, where I would say nothing I can say that could improve this program. And that's in a long while. So every year I've been looking at literature, wanting to find a successful nutrition education program in sub-Saharan Africa. And in order for it to be successful, you don't need any experts. Mm-hmm. You want ordinary people to routinely do what is right. It hasn't happened. The science, in other words, hadn't worked. So I wasn't doing enough work to keep my wife happy, because she likes me working hard, doing good things, and I was sitting around thinking. And she got mad with me, but she won, because she said, at least you could do a Bible study with the African graduates in the village who are unemployed. Now, some of you may even know this experience. You know, have you had anybody in your family or that you know has gone off to university, got a degree, and then when they come back, the only thing they won't do is work? That's what happens, isn't it? They won't work anymore. They won't do anything that gets their hands dirty. That's not what should happen. But it's what's happening. So I thought about that for a moment. I said, well, yes, I should do that. Because even if you'd taken a biochemistry class from me in Ottawa, you would go away with a reading list which wasn't biochemistry, which would last you for the rest of your life. In other words, you, after a course from me, you might be unpaid, but you should never be unemployed again. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't happening. Medical students couldn't pass the simplest exam when they become doctors that they took in year one. I know that all the doctors in this room, if they remember any biochemistry at all, it's probably the name of the Krebs cycle. Mm. They couldn't write it down. And even if they could, it doesn't matter, because if you don't have a Krebs cycle, you're dead. The bits of biochemistry you need to know are much more detailed and complex than that. So we're not, in fact, training people as we used to do in university for many, many centuries, to build an intellectual structure for their life which would make their families and their communities do better than they did before. The university was supposed to be about wisdom a long while ago, and you haven't thought about that in university at all, have you, during your courses? See, the ancient world that gave us medicine was the Christian world. There were no hospitals until after Christ came. Christ changed the world in a very significant way, the way we think, the way we operate, and it's still spreading outwards. But early on in the Christian history, in the first few centuries, they understood what the basic target was. And that is that children should be trained to use their minds to control their wills, to control their passions. Got that? Mm. Your children have to learn to use their minds to control their will, to control their passion. Is that what you feel happens in education now? Mm. Not at all. That is wisdom. But we don't teach wisdom anymore because we have no agreement about where it is. So T.S. Eliot, a great English poet, wrote over 70 years ago, he said, "Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information?" See, when a medical student writes something down and learns it by heart, it's information that they have. But that is useless unless they know how to use it. Then it becomes knowledge. It's wisdom when they know whether they should use it or not. And we don't teach wisdom at all. So we are now having, in our part of the world, smart churches now are training patient advocates so that when old people go to the hospital system or the health system, somebody goes with them who's well educated to protect them from the medical system. Mm. That's not good news. So we started this Bible study, and my wife again suggested what it should be, that it should be Deuteronomy. Now, I doubt it's anyone's favourite book in the Bible, right? Anybody got Deuteronomy at the top of their list? Probably not. But you know, it was our Lord's favourite book. He quoted from Deuteronomy more than any other text in the Old Testament. And in fact, it matters a lot. And when you understand what matters, you might be on the way to change. Because the Jews are the most successful nation on earth. Every year, when the Nobel Prizes, the major prizes in science, are given out every year, they are won by Jews. 15 million people take sometimes half of the Nobel Prizes. Even they are embarrassed by it. And all those cell phones and things. Yeah, the Americans claim they make them. All the software is written by Israelis. And it's the way they raise their children. And they never taught us. Well, they don't do it very well. It's about how you raise your children. In fact, development is more about children than anything else, in my view. In fact, I would argue that the fact that Christianity captured the ancient pagan world was about childcare. The first letter that I know, written by a Roman governor to Rome, asking about the Christians, said this: "These Christians are not exposing their own children, and they are rescuing the exposed children of others. What should I do?" Now, what he's talking about is the ancient equivalent to abortion. Throughout human history, we have always killed our babies. We have always thought that the next baby we don't want. All societies have done that until Christ arrived. And the Jews didn't do it very much. They did a little bit, but very, very little. They were different on that too. But in general, it's been the normal pattern. And in the ancient world, there was no abortion, but there was a place at the city gates where you could drop a baby down if you didn't want it. And if somebody wanted to pick it up, they could. Otherwise, it was left to die and the dogs ate it. And nobody cared. It didn't matter to them. And then these Christians started behaving differently. I guess there was no church organised at that time. It was before that happened. But what they had clearly had is a meeting with Christ that changed their lives. And it was gossiped around the Mediterranean. wasn't taught didactically. People looked different, and somebody said to them, "What's happened to you?" And they said, "Well, I've learned about Jesus." And they said, "Has that changed you? Would it change me?" That's the way it spread. And I've no doubt it was largely the poorest end of society initially that was involved. There were some others as well, but dominantly the lowest levels. And so this is artistic license on my part, but I imagine a little church group that developed saying something like this to one another: "Aren't we blessed? Life has been so much better since Christ came into our life. So much better." And then they said, "But we're pregnant, and we don't think we can handle another baby. But that baby is a gift from God too, isn't it? So how can it be bad?" And they had the courage, perhaps, almost certainly they needed a group to do it. And you know what you would say to one another if you got to that kind of conversation. Said, "Well, we'll help." And so they started accepting their babies. And they found, of course, that things got better rather than worse. Because babies make communities when you start caring for them and helping one another. They help you to help one another more if you accept them joyfully. And that's what they began to do. And then imagine the next step. They actually started picking up other people's babies. Now, just imagine, mainly little girls. The girls were thrown away more than the boys. Imagine you were a little girl and you got to the age of 12, say. And then mum and dad said, "We have a story to tell you about how you came into our family. Because you came in a very special way. We were walking through the city gates and you were lying in the dirt. And the love of Christ, the love of Jesus, so flowed through us at that moment that we had to pick you up. And we are so glad we did." Do you have to preach the gospel to that girl?
Yeah.
It's done, isn't it? Signed, sealed and delivered. It's pure St. Francis. Preach the gospel. If necessary, use words. It was seen. The Romans never solved the problem. They became more and more sexually decadent, and therefore their population dropped. The Christians had children and loved them. That also leads to healthier living. They lived longer, and they took over the Roman Empire in 3 centuries. And we are the products of that. It took 8 centuries to recover from the destruction of the Roman Empire, which was a very effective empire. But it died in the usual ways. It took 8 centuries to happen. But by the end of the so-called Dark Ages, which were not dark, Europe had changed. At the end of the Roman Empire, the beginning of the Christian era in political terms, slavery was the norm. And if you went into a garden, there would be a disgusting statue of some sort in the middle of it. 8 centuries later, without any legislation, slavery had disappeared in Europe. And if you found a garden, it would be a monastery garden, and it would be a cross, or a Madonna, or a saint. The soul of Europe had been purged. It had been cleaned up. It took 8 centuries, but it had been done. And we started going astray again around the end of the 14th century. The problems we have today have their roots that far back. So that's the big story, but Deuteronomy. The reason I was interested in it was I had the great privilege of hearing a wonderful scholar talk about covenant in the Old Testament in Ottawa. And one sentence in particular got to me. He said, if you ask an Orthodox Jew, why are the Jews so successful? They will say, go read Deuteronomy 6. And I imagine that, like me, you couldn't tell me at the moment what Deuteronomy 6 is about. But I hope that at the end of the next half hour or so, you will never forget again. Because it's what made the Jews successful. Now, Deuteronomy is Moses telling the children of Israel what they must do if they are going to flourish, if they are going to succeed. In other words, if you want to know about success, don't listen to prosperity gospel stuff. Listen to Moses. It's much deeper, it's much richer, and it clearly works. And what he says is this. First of all, he's not going to go into the promised land, but What he does is he says, look, before I leave you, I want to give you instructions, parting instructions. And he begins with reminding them of their gifts from God. And he asks them, he says, he puts it this way, he says, you will neglect even the greatest gift that God has given you. Now, what is the greatest gift that God gave to the Jews?
Jesus. Jesus.
Well, that came a lot later. He gave Jesus to the whole world. But what about the Jews as such? The Ten Commandments and all that flows from it, the Torah. And he's very politically incorrect. He doesn't do any multicultural rubbish. He says, our culture, because it's got the law from God, is the best one going. And he says, even the nations around you will recognize that your law is better than theirs. And they did, over time. And we have to acknowledge in the Western world, insofar as we have justice, it comes from the Jews. And insofar as we have compassion, it comes from the Christians. Historically, that's the way it happened. So, he says, but you will forget your law. You will not take it seriously. And they didn't. Then he reminds them something that modern evangelical Christians in particular need to think about. He reminds them of their meeting with God at Mount Sinai. Now, how many of you would call yourselves born-again Christians? A few. How many go to Pentecostal churches, for instance? Yeah. Well, he's saying that you can get this wrong. He says, the most important thing is not how you feel. The people who were at Mount Sinai, they had God speak to them in a voice they knew to be God's, accompanied by a small volcano and thunder and lightning. Now, if God has come into your life, I doubt you had anything quite as dramatic as that, right? But that's what he did to the Jews. And if you ask an Orthodox Jew, he says, we lost our free will on that occasion. Because if God came and spoke to us now, we'd be flat on our faces. We could never after that experience say that God doesn't exist. So the Jews say God took our free will away at that moment. But he doesn't take free will away from anyone else. And the reason for that, I think, is very straightforward. God doesn't want you to fear him in that sense. He wants you to love him. What you're invited into in the Christian story is a love story. Can you force someone to love you? No. That's why he doesn't use his power. He does leave enough lying around if you're watching to see that he still loves you. That's what it's about. And so Moses, they hear this and they say, we will obey the law. And then Moses goes to talk to God. And while Moses was still talking to God, they broke the first three commandments in order. I mean, the experience of God does not make you good. Just as conversion does not make you good, it makes you redeemed. You are under new management, not totally transformed magically. That's why there is not a single place in the New Testament that makes you responsible for how you feel. Let me misquote. You understand what I say by misquote? I'm going to misquote St. Paul. And I want you to raise your hand if you can tell me what I've done to you. All right? In other words, you've got to spot the error. Paul says something like this. Every epistle he writes is a great long lot of theology. And every epistle is written for practical reasons. The church was making major mistakes. So in Corinthians, sexual life was totally out of control. And Paul said, that's got to change. The Thessalonians were so into Christ coming again, they'd become totally lazy and they weren't working. The Galatians were so obsessed with the Holy Spirit, so upset with the Holy Spirit that they kept him out of the church. They were making mistakes. And each epistle is directed at dealing with those mistakes. And usually it will say something like this at the end of the epistle. If you have understood what I have been saying to you, then you must not be like the people around you. You must be transformed by the renewal of your feelings. Now, how many of you know what I've done to you? I said to raise your hand. Yeah. That's But for most people, they go to church to feel better.
Mm.
But that's the wrong reason.
Mm.
You go to church to think better, which usually makes you feel terrible.
Mm-hmm.
You will feel good when you are obedient. And that's God's doing, not yours.
Yeah.
Now let's misquote again. At this time, you don't have to tell me immediately. Just put your hand up if you understand. In another epistle, he says that the preaching of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. But to those who have been saved, it is the power of God. This one's a bit more difficult, but just as important. No hands going up this time. You want a second bite?
Sorry, repeat that again.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're listening carefully. Paul says that the preaching of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. But to those who have been saved, it is the power of God.
I'm going to take a guess. Are being saved, not
exactly,
having
yes, yes.
Saving.
Hmm? Are being saved, not have been saved.
Okay.
The witness on church on Sunday morning should be to the ways in which in the last week you have been saved.
Mm-hmm.
The way in which God's control over your life has been extended.
Mm-hmm.
That's the object of the exercise. Paul assumes step one. But he says you're not getting on with step two, being changed, which is our job with the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Now, Moses picks this up. He doesn't pick it up, he's there first. But when he comes down the mountain, obviously appalled, but he says, God heard what you said. And God's response was, oh, that this people would have such a heart and mind as this to keep my law. Anybody complete the verse? That it might go well with you and your children forever.
Mm-hmm.
The law is not an imposition. Not at all. Another biblical literacy one. Let's see if I can catch it again. Of course, if you get it wrong in public, you never forget the answer again. It's a marvellous learning experience.
It's true.
So, the same phrase introduces the first thou shalt not in both Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. What is it? What, in other words, introduces the law in the Old Testament?
Thou shalt not forget.
No. Good try. No? Not this time. It's this. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. Could they get out of Egypt on their own?
No.
No way. No way they get out of Egypt on their own. Grace brought them out of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that amazing? In the Old Testament, the law is introduced by grace. Now, does God change his nature between I am the Lord your God who brought you out of nature, out of Egypt, and thou shalt not? Of course he doesn't. So, how is the law also grace? It is. All that Jesus did, and what when the New Testament says you are no longer under the law, doesn't mean the law is gone. It means the law, you might now be able to see what it's really for. Read Matthew 5 and you see Jesus teaching that. Paul later puts it in a very simple phrase. He says, the law is a schoolmaster to bring you to Christ. Without the law, you won't get there. Now, how does it work? It's actually very easy to see once you think about it. And I'll do it by story, because you will remember the story forever. I know that. It's a true story. And it happened to me in Canada a few years ago, in the middle of the prairies, which is in the middle of Canada. It's a very cold place. I mean, at this time of year, it's still minus 10, and it goes down to minus 40 in the winter, if you can imagine a temperature like that. And the people who live there, a lot of them are Mennonites. These are very religious people, Protestant Christians, pacifists. They will not go to war. And they were pushed around in Russia, they were pushed around in Germany. A lot of them ended up in Canada. And they settled in communities. Wonderful communities. And I was asked to go and speak at one of these communities a few years ago now. And being a real community, half of them turned up for the talk, which was in church. I don't remember what I talked about, but I talked too long, as I often do. And then it was too late to go back to the main city that night. So the doctor who invited me to give the talk took me to his home for the night. And he drove into his garage in his nice car. He did not lock his car. He did not lock the garage. He left the ignition key in the car. He takes me into his house and pushes the door shut. He doesn't lock it. There are no bars on any window. And he says, "Your room is the one at the top of the stairs. Do you need anything? It's late." I said, "No," but I couldn't resist. I said, "Isn't it a little careless to leave the ignition key in the car?" And he shrugged and said, "Oh, you never know who may need it." Can you imagine that? Can you imagine going home tonight and not locking anything because somebody might need something? That's what happens when the law is deeply built into your society. You see, in that community, they've been teaching for 150 years that thou shalt not steal is a gift. And it defines what sort of people we are. Isn't that wonderful? Can you imagine it? So nobody locks anything. Even when people go away on a holiday, they don't lock their house. Because somebody might need something. And then they'll have to break a window to get in. That's stupid. Of course, if you start to steal in that community, you stick out like a sore thumb. And people say, "Why did you do that?" Because you will get caught, because nobody else does it. And they'll say, "If you really need it, ask and we'll give it to you. If you don't really need it but you want it, we'll give you a job. And if you don't think that's a good idea, you won't fit here." That's what the law does. The law is a framework within which, and only within which, true freedom can happen. Freedom is a very popular word in South Africa, isn't it? But it's not properly defined. What do most people mean by freedom? I think they mean free to do whatever I want, right? And you might add, as long as I don't hurt anyone else, but a lot of people are doing what they want and hurting other people, right? And calling it freedom. But freedom for a Christian is different and better. Christian freedom is the freedom to do what you ought. In other words, for your mind to control your will, to control your passions. That's true freedom. That Mennonite village has true freedom. They don't like one, and they chose. Now, it's not that outstanding, actually. We moved to the country later, and in fact, for several years, we've had a vehicle. It's not a very good vehicle, I admit. We lock a good vehicle. We don't have as much faith as Mennonites. But we have a second vehicle that you need in the country. And that was left in the drive in the barn, and people knew it for years. And it was very good because people used it, and I got some gas. So I never had to fill it up. It was a backup car, which we needed. That's what Christianity does over time. Malnutrition is like it too. And that's what was amazing for me to realise. The World Bank is very liberal and very opposed to what I'm saying in respects, but they provide me with the data because they use prevalence, how much malnutrition a society has, as a sort of inverse indicator of development. If you have a lot of malnutrition, you've got a lot of development to do. If you have none, you've made it.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the criteria. There are many, but they use malnutrition. Now, malnutrition's problem, it happens to anyone when there's famine or war. But the problem in Africa is that I can go into any village south of the equator at the beginning of the dry season, when the harvest is in, and find malnourished children. I don't have to take anything with me. I can find it in the village. It just isn't being properly distributed. And it's not malicious, it's just that there is an acceptance of these things happening. This is kind of fatalism. Now, the Jews never get malnutrition except in war and famine. Enculturated Protestants, not people who go to church, but people who have more than a 300-year history of the church being active and respected in their environment. They don't get malnutrition. The Catholics get a little, but only in South America, where they've accepted too much animism into the church. Muslims, even in wealthy, oil rich countries still have malnutrition.
Mm.
Buddhists and Hindus have malnutrition too. And animists, people who believe that the world is controlled by evil spirits, which is a lot of South Asia and still Africa, isn't it? I mean, you see patients every day. If you ask them, how did this disease happen? They would say an evil spirit did it.
Mm.
That has got to go, and it will go over time. Because when Christ comes, evil spirits depart.
Mm.
Until you ask them back, which is what Europe is doing. It's a terrifying situation we're in at the moment. So, how does it work for the Jews? And this is really the most beautiful bit of all. The bit that matters most, another bit of biblical illiteracy. The centre of Jewish thought is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. Now, can anybody complete the verse? Hmm? Try, did good. I didn't quite ask. Here. Mind is in the New Testament. And that's because Jesus knew about us. You don't need mind for Jews when you've got heart. Because Jews will not separate heart and mind. So you can use either and you get both. But not for us. So Jesus knew about us. He added that in the New Testament. But complete the verse. Any of you thinking, and your neighbour is yourself, and you didn't say it? Why not? Because you didn't want to be wrong in public, right? And you are. Because that's in Leviticus. So you'll never forget that now. It's permanent memory. I should charge you for it. Really. Deuteronomy is so much more interesting, especially for people doing the work you do. It's, these things shall be upon your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your children. When you sit at table, when you rise up, when you lie down, and you go on your journey. The success of the Jews is dependent upon families, and particularly with men having meals with their small children and throughout their children's lives. Now, I won't ask the men, it's ask the women. What percentage of men in this part of Africa have meals with their small children? Some of you look as though it's a thought that's never crossed your mind, right?
Children are chased away.
Yeah.
What?
Children are chased away.
That's right, isn't it? But the heart of Judaism is that the father loves his children by being present when they have a messy meal.
Mm-hmm.
And even more than that, who eats first in an African family?
The father.
But he'd eat last in a Jewish family.
Yes.
In fact, if I had one, well, not me, just a few, last year or so, a friend of mine wrote an article in a magazine in Canada. He's a doctor. And he was writing about the prescription that he was in the US, sorry, the prescription that he wants to write every week but cannot. Can any of you guess what it is?
Spend more time with the children.
Well, even more precisely than that, his prescription is one dad.
Mm.
Not one just biologically, but a dad in the child's life.
Yeah.
And he's right.
Mm.
And the Jews understand that it's father's job to teach all the stories of the Bible to his children. Now, the Bible is not putting women down. Women are always doing too much. Well, one of their major functions is to make men do what they ought. I told my daughters, your major function in life is to civilize at least one male. And that's what needs to happen. And in Jewish families it does. I mean, Jewish inheritance is through the mother. But father has to do this job. And that's because children have hypocrisy detectors. Have you noticed that?
That is very true.
They know when what you're saying is what you do.
Yeah.
They can see the difference. They don't. It's not there immediately. It takes a little while. You have about 7 years before your children know that you're not as good as you say you are. That you're a hypocrite, basically. They know. And then they start doing what you taught them to do. They rationalise their own desires. But if you do some Bible stories, very interesting thing happens. But let me ask you one other question first. What's the difference between the response you get from, say, a 7-year-old and an under 5 to the question, would you like a story? Now, in African society, you don't have as much access to books as we do. But while I tell my answer, I'll watch your faces and I'll know whether you read to children. The 7-year-old will go to her bedroom in our family. We have 21 grandchildren, so we see this a lot. And she'll bring the book she's in the middle of, and she'll sit there and keep you sitting there reading as long as you will. Mm. They will cancel all other activities to be read to by parents or grandparents. The under fives, even in our house, they have their own cupboard, their own shelf of books. They will go and fetch a favourite book. I've read it lots of times. I get bored very, very easily. So I try and shorten it. Yeah. Some of you read to children. Grandad, have you forgotten how to read?
Yes.
And this is certainly true in African villages, isn't it? There are stories which the children want to be word perfect, right? And in many villages that I've been to, it's usually a 12 or 13-year-old who is responsible for telling the stories because he's good at it and he'd better get it right. Word perfect stories are a requirement in every culture I've been to. Amongst children under the age of 5. So God did it. Why? I think what they're trying to do is to find out how I grow up to be a proper member of this group.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the stories are for. You don't teach your children anywhere near as much by clouting them or hitting them as you do by telling them the important stories.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it works is brilliant. And the type of story you get determines what type of society you're dealing with. There are only half a dozen books in the world that are important enough to run big societies. The biggest one of all is the one that is currently fading in Africa and needs to fade, and that's the belief in evil spirits, technically animism, where everything is explained, and reasonably so. You see, all these stories have the function of making life understandable. Now, you go a few 1,000 miles north of where we are now, where there's been war for the last 20 years, your children don't make it to adult life, 30% of the tribe have got horrible diseases, your government is totally corrupt. I mean, what evidence of a God of love is there in that story? Not very much at all. But evil spirits make perfect sense of it. It even explains why one family loses their children, the next one don't. Even immunisation further north is understood as magic, not as science. Like, why shouldn't they? A little needle with some clear fluid, and the child who has it doesn't get measles. The one who doesn't does. That's magic. Magic's a perfect explanation, especially when you have people going around injecting saline and charging for it, and then it looks even more like magic or bad magic in that case. That doesn't work. They don't think it in those terms. When I started a nutrition program in Central Africa and trained some nurses to recognise malnutrition, 1 year later, when I went back, one of the nurses I'd trained had had his own child die of malnutrition. Now, that was an insult. And I said, what on earth went wrong? And he told me he wasn't going to tell me the truth because he looked at the gram, not at me. And he told me what he knew I wanted to hear, that we didn't feed him properly. But I also knew he didn't believe that. I sent my supervisor, what did he believe? I want to know. 2 minutes later, he comes back, he says, well, he believes that an evil spirit took the child's appetite away, so he'd spent his money on the witch doctor.
Mm-hmm.
A perfectly rational thing to do, if you believe the world is controlled by evil spirits.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do believe the world is controlled by evil spirits, science doesn't make any sense. Because the crown jewel of science, it's the fact that I believe, and people who do science believe, that if I did an experiment here today in Bethesda and then sent a message to someone in London and they did the same experiment, I expect them to get the same answer. But if evil spirits control the world, there's no way that would happen. Different evil spirits, different outcomes. And we are logical, but slowly. So if you believe in evil spirits, you will not do science properly. It will get in the way. And also, you see, what made science take off was very much Christian. it brought together the very least and the very greatest in the church. People with manual skills met people with intellectual skills, and they talked to one another. That was really productive. And once Luther taught that whatever you do should be done to the glory of God, now you did things in order to understand God's world, not because of the outcome. Most people now want science to be something that gives you a job, right? When your children go off to get educated, the thing you want most is a job, isn't it? That's what you think education is about, a job. Well, it isn't. What science and the university started with was the question of, this is God's world, how has he made it? And most of the major advances in science that made the others possible were not practical to begin with. They were just people who were driven by the desire to know how God had made the world. And they discovered things which had no immediate use. But they did it for the glory of God. The man who first gave us a proper model of how the planets move, Kepler, was a deeply committed Christian. And when he got it, he was honest enough. He said, I didn't work this out. I was looking at the problem and God showed me the answer. And he wrote in his lab book a prayer praising God for the way he had made the cosmos. It's an amazing prayer. He had no practical application at that point. The man who invented electricity, not the electric light bulb, but electricity, was a man called Faraday. He was a deeply committed Christian. He had no education formally beyond about the age 11. He was self-educated after 11, and yet he became president of the Royal Institute. And he discovered electric fields, and everybody laughed, but he was right. Deeply, deeply committed Christian. And he did it because God gave him his talents and he blessed God for it and he did it. Now, practical things flowed from that, didn't they? I mean, we wouldn't be having this meeting with this light if it wasn't for Michael Faraday. And he was a man who stopped committee meetings so that he could get to his prayer meeting. He took his faith seriously. In fact, all these men have this in common. Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, Newton, Boyle, Faraday, Clark's Maxwell, Eddington. That's one stream of physics and chemistry. Every single one of those names is people with a really committed faith. And that's not taught in school anymore. It should be. So the Jews, their story is the richest, the best, in many ways. And you get a Jew with Jewish ethics. And what's different about them, and they're better than Christians at this, we haven't got there yet, is they're the only nation in the world that tells the truth about their own history. Every other nation makes their heroes better than they really were. You wouldn't actually like to meet Shaka on the street tonight, would you? Unless you knew he was on your side. You certainly wouldn't want to meet Robin Hood either. He was a similar sort of character. And the Jews recognise that. So in their history it says, the kings, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord, 10 times in a row. Mm-hmm. So when you're dealing with a Jew, he looks at you and he says, it's a 10-to-1 probability you're trying to cheat me. Mm-hmm. So they're not taking for a ride. But they also know that the third commandment, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, is actually about promise keeping. Mm. If you claim to be a Christian, and you make a promise, and you do not keep it, you're breaking the third commandment. And that commandment is the essential prerequisite for a banking system. And it's breaking down. When the wall broke down between the communist East and the West, and the Russians opened banks, if you were stupid enough to put money in a Russian bank, you never saw it again. It's an incredible act of faith. Put some money on a counter and get a piece of paper back and think that everything's okay. Christians couldn't run their own banking system for 1,000 years. We weren't honest enough. Only the Jews could do it. But they're losing their way too now. So the story your children inhabit will determine what kind of ethics they have. And the animistic story, the village story, is usually, isn't it? Stories about animals. And little animals beat big animals by trickery, right? That's throughout the whole thing. Yeah. It's the west coast, it's the centre, it's down here, it's in the Caribbean, and it comes up into America. Just that you see, and you go to Nigeria being the best place for this, and their trickery is accepted. And if you manage to beat one, an official by trickery, you know, you take him on, you win. They say, good, and he'll let you go. He won't force the bribe out. If it's very clever, that's very clever, off you go. But it doesn't lead to productivity. Yeah, got to stop. Just a minute or two more. What story are you teaching your children is the question. They will learn all the stories they hear before the age of seven by heart. Don't tell them what they mean, what it means. Wait till they ask why and how. The only thing you need to do with a child, if you want them to grow up well, is to see they know all the Bible stories before the age of seven. Then you have given them a reference bank for how to behave. And even a simple phrase, I don't know what it would be in your language, but somebody here who does speak the local language, I don't know who it would be, someone can tell me. In the story of Esther, it says, maybe you were born for such a time as this. Do you know that phrase in the local language? Can anybody translate for such a time as this? Can you do it?
No.
No? Can you do it? The story of Esther. You know the story in the Old Testament?
Yes.
When Mordecai says, perhaps you were born for such a time as this.
Close enough.
Well, you can talk about it afterwards, but the point is that when the Bible has been built into a society, an English-speaking society, any girl who knows the story of Esther only needs the phrase, for such a time as this, to know that she is required to be courageous, and what courage is. That's what it does. It makes us richer than we realise in language. Now I'm told I have to stop to see if you have any questions, so I will. But I know it's also a little difficult to ask questions, because I know you don't normally have talks like this. Are there any questions? You've had time to think about it for some years. You could tell them about how you heard about the Hittites.
Yeah, it was more a coincidence that I couldn't have controlled, but John and Sally came to talk in Durban at a conference, and my friends had pretty much been forced to go to their conference by their parents, because their parents knew the content of this conference, the Christian Medical Fellowship, an international conference even. And so they paid for their son and daughter to attend this conference, and they happened to be in my class. And the son shared a room with John and liked so much of the talks that he heard and just the interaction that I think he phoned his parents and said, you've got to get this guy to come to Cape Town. So they had the time, then maybe the flight wasn't...
I booked for an extra week, I don't know why, but I did. Yeah.
So they had time, but they didn't know what they were going to do at that time. So they came, this is in 98, to give a repetition of this conference in Durban. And I had been blocked from going. I'd applied, and my consultant said, no, I can't do it. I can't miss obstetrics. So I fought with them a little bit, then lost the fight. You can't miss obstetrics. So now I spent the time when they were in Durban doing obstetrics for a week, and then I was supposed to go for my practical. And we were sent out to the clinic to learn just the basics of delivering babies and watching a bit of that. On day one of that, we got hijacked in the afternoon. Now, I didn't spend a lot of my youth going into townships. I was a very secluded suburban life in Cape Town. And now I've never probably seen a gun, let alone have a gun pulled on me in the car. So the whole of that week, my brain wasn't functioning very well. I was supposed to be studying for an exam at the end of that week for forensics, another exam. And I would sit at my desk and I couldn't focus. And instead of then wasting my time at my desk, these talks were happening. So I think from Monday to Friday or Monday to Thursday, every night I was listening to these talks. And after, I think back then we were using tape. And those audio cassette tapes we kept and shared them amongst each other. So now I've had a chance to listen to them again. The Deuteronomy 6 talk is what sank in for me. That's why I asked him to speak on it. if you are looking for maybe your own copy of the talk, we can link you to how to get it on MP3. Because there's a lot in this talk, there's multiple topics that you can listen on your phone. And maybe at night after work, you can just go through one of the talks and then, or with a friend, and try and ask each other, what exactly are we getting at here? Because there's, I don't know how many, but we only had about five.
There are lots of them, but yeah. And for me, it's what a wonderful thing to travel around the world and find that somebody you didn't really think a lot about has been useful in somebody else's life. And that's the best thing that can happen to any human being. It happens to me all the while, and that's wonderful. Any questions? What are your hopes in getting African husbands to behave like Jewish husbands? That's your project. Small one. It does happen. The first time I taught this out of doors in Africa, in Zaire, over 20 years ago, to about, I think it was about 6,000 people. The tribal elders had heard what I was teaching the young people, said, you have to teach everybody. It's not fair just to teach the young. So I did. And I think it was a day or so afterwards, Sammy was being driven by an African driver, our driver, and he said, after listening to John, I went home and for the first time had a meal with my children. Very countercultural. And he says, I noticed that one of my children was a slow eater. They eat from a common pot. So I gave him his own plate. That's malnutrition gone in that family. One afternoon of Deuteronomy 6 did more than 30 years of nutrition education lectures.
I've offered a million-rand prize to the new doctor, or the previous new doctor, Dr. Jacobs. I said if he can eliminate herbal intoxication in this community, I'll give him £1 million. I think part of the elimination is listening to talks like this. I've worked for about 15 years, and wherever I've moved, I've seen the cover marks and the herbal intoxication. In fact, Jason sent a message to the group today on WhatsApp saying, there's a kid with herbal intoxication, 3 weeks old, coming from Kwizi Clinic. Maybe we delivered that kid 3 weeks ago. I need to be having maybe a way of saying this message in the postnatal ward. I mean, the moms are there. They're almost like a captive audience and say, is there a way that we can guarantee that your baby will be free of tatan, free of enema? And what to give in place of that? Is there a way of... Because I think I'm not Zulu enough to understand, but breast milk alone maybe is not given. It has to be something else. And I don't know if it happens in the Christian households. Does it?
They're not going to say yes to you.
Maybe it does. I don't know. I mean, someone I know well came with a brilliant Zulu Bible in picture form. So nice that I want one for myself to improve my Zulu. But she's wearing spandlers. She's making ceremonies for the ancestors. But yet she's going to church every Sunday. I don't understand it. It's like it's two different worlds at the same time.
Well, you'll get the questions tomorrow when I'm there. But thank you for listening anyway.
If there's still room for one question.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
You were talking about how the breakdown of right and or good and evil in society, how in Europe at least you were mostly going to church to feel good and not learn
to think,
how to think and be good actually. How can you change that? How can we... Do you have any...
Oh, yeah.
You talked about educating our children. There's something we can do to our colleagues, to those going to church with us.
Well, we can do a lot more, actually. But we've got to redevelop the Christian mind. And I've been doing that for the last 20 years. Just to make it plain that some other people are thinking about this, We were a small group of us started this tiny college, which teaches the history of ideas in 8 months, from the perspective that you can only understand yourself as a product of the Western world, as the product of Hebrew and Greek thought modified by the church. And it's worked incredibly well. But one of the most amazing things that happened is that the little group who started this were headhunted by the Chinese government about 25 years ago. It was very hard for us to believe. A little group of 20 professors who met for breakfast once a week in Ottawa, and the Chinese government knew about us. We used to read in a little restaurant, and we have a quick breakfast, and then we talk for an hour. We read everything from 2,500 years ago to the present on the nature of education. It was a marvelous group. I was the dummy of the group. Everybody else spoke 5 languages or more. Anyway, we got this email from Hong Kong, which was not part of China at that point. This bears on your question. And it said, we know about you. We would like to take you out to breakfast. And they wanted to take us to a nice hotel further down the street. So we said, yes. When we got there, there were these gentlemen from Hong Kong. And they said, we're here for the Beijing government. And we're looking for teachers in China. And we said, well, you've come to the wrong place. That's a Marxist government, and we're all Christian. And they said, we know you're Christian. That's why we want you. They said, that doesn't make sense. And they said, well, have breakfast, and we'll explain. And I wish we had governments like this in the West. I'm sure you wish you had governments as thoughtful as they turned out to be. They said, remember, this is 25 years ago. And they said, you in the West think that we in China are backward technically and economically. We are going to fix both those problems. And to a large degree, they have. But they said, that isn't our real problem. Our real problem is also the real problem of South Africa. What is it? Corruption. Corruption. And they said, that's not so easy to fix. And one of the major problems is the Western world is dedicated to a solution which won't work. They think it's education. And I can prove it isn't. Raise your hand if you are good. Nobody, you see. Nobody raises their hand. Now, you've told me 2 things immediately about yourself. You've told me that you actually know what good and evil are. And you've also told me you are not doing the good consistently. Now, if you know what goodness is and you could do it and you're not a very nice person. But that isn't your problem, is it? You have the same problem that I have. I begin the day wishing to do good things and avoid bad things, and at the end of the day, I've done it sometimes and not others. It's not a problem of knowledge, it's a problem of the training of the will. And the Chinese have worked this through incredibly well. They'd said, we know that teaching ethics to university students will not make them better. It may make them more sophisticated. It will not make them good. And we realize it's something that happens to Western children before they go to school. And it has to come from children's stories. Not the Bible, by and large. But, of course, Christian stories in the Western world, all the pictures, all the metaphors, they're from the Bible. The best children's stories in the Western tradition have deeply Christian motifs. So the children learn the stories by those pictures that are in the language. Now, in Africa, the bits in the language are these animal stories. In the Muslim world, they're Quranic stories. And in the Hindu world, they're from their stories, from the Veda. And the Chinese said, we've looked at all the stories of the world. The only ones that have produced science and ethics, which is what we want, are Judeo-Christian. So they wanted the Bible in English literature to be taught to kindergarten teachers, whom they brought from all over China for David Jeffrey to teach. Can you believe it? The Communist Party of China, on the platform in the major university in China, Beijing, and on over the top, the Bible in English literature, with a Communist Party official sitting there, and David teaching them what redemption was in English literature. That is astonishing. And of course, China is probably currently having the fastest growth in the church anywhere in the world. something of the order of 60,000 conversions a day.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to change them. Yep.
Why did they ask the Jews to do that talk? Because a lot of the stories we tell our kids, like David and Goliath, it's a Jewish story that the Christians just have tacked onto the New Testament.
Because they know the Jews are insular. They don't do the missionary thing at all.
No, they don't.
And they should have done. Even Peter had to be bullied quite extensively to make him into a missionary. Yeah. So, it's education. But education in the Western world refuses to ask the first questions. So, for instance, when you're talking about Genesis 1, don't talk to somebody who's an unbeliever until they've answered the first question. In the beginning, what? Someone or something? It's got to be one of the two. And actually, at this stage, someone makes more sense than something.
Mm-hmm.
So the department of the modern university with the most Christians is physics.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly, it will be molecular biology joining them.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we're discovering is so incredible that everybody's beginning to rock back on their heels.
Meaning they're becoming Christians in that department? Yeah. Or they get attracted to that department?
No, they're becoming Christians in that department.
Wow.
Francis Collins himself, the director of the Human Genome Project, became a Christian in his 30s because of what he was discovering. And lots of people are. People want to leave, you should set them free.
Oh, you're free. If anyone would like tea or ask...
Well, if you want to come and ask a question on your own.